The Guardian.
Tonight, history in the making.
We're moving from recession to recovery, and I believe we're moving on a road to prosperity for all.
We can go on as we are, or we can say no, Britain can do much better.
I think we have a fantastic opportunity to do things differently.
Well, that was all a bit exciting, wasn't it? Welcome back to Media Talk. Coming up on this week's podcast, Politics Goes Prime Time, we give our verdict on the historic leaders' debate. Also in the podcast, the hunt begins for a new controller of Radio 4 after Mark Damaser swaps Ambridge for Oxbridge. Plus, Twitter announces plans to turn a profit and...
This afternoon, I made my way to a makeshift headmaster's study to receive on my backside what thousands of kids from yesteryear got on a routine basis.
Adrian Childs gets another spanking as Chris Evans is brought in to present The One Show on Fridays. I'm Matt Wells, this is Media Talk from The Guardian. Dear, that was Whitney Houston, whose performance at the LG Arena in Birmingham this week left thousands of fans demanding a refund. Well, have no fear, dear listener. My two panellists have been warming up their larynxes and dusting off their back catalogue to ensure that there's no bum notes in this show. Steve Busfield is The Guardian's Head of Media and Technology. I think we've just got one scheduled costume change for you today. Isn't that right?
Am I going to have a shave halfway through?
Yeah. Also in the pod, making his debut, in fact, is Dan Saber, formerly The Times media editor, founder of the media news website Beehive City. How is life after Whopping treating you, Dan?
Life after Whopping is rather good fun, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Enjoying being an internet star?
I think that's a bit optimistic, but really enjoying publishing online and learned a hell of a lot about new media.
Excellent. Well, you can put all that into practice today. There is really only one place to start this week. If you were flicking through the channels on Thursday night, you could have tuned into Pineapple Dance Studios on Sky One, or you might have stumbled upon The World's Strictest Parents on BBC Three, or perhaps you were enjoying Our Country House Rescue on Channel 4. But over on ITV1, of course, history was being made in the form of the first ever British televised party leaders' debate.
There's no newspaper editor done as much for me in the last 2 years, because my face is smiling on these posters, and I'm very grateful to you and Lord Ashcroft for funding that.
David Cameron!
Thank you. If you work hard, I'll be behind you. If you're old and you become ill, we will always be there for you. This is an amazing country. We've done incredible things. I think we can go on and do even more incredible things.
Don't let them tell you that the only choice is between two old parties who've been playing pass the parcel with your government for 65 years now.
You can't airbrush your policies, even though you can airbrush your posters.
In one sentence, Mr. Cameron.
Gordon Brown is trying to make you believe he can protect health spending, he can protect education spending, he can protect police spending. He cannot do any of these things.
I believe the way things are is not the way things have to be.
Congratulations, boys. You're all still in the running to become Britain's next top prime minister. Dan, this was being billed as a watershed moment in British politics and media. What did you make of it?
It's a bit disappointing in some ways, actually. It's certainly the way it started with ITV's rather sort of dire graphics, and then suddenly we were sort of straight into this historic event with almost no build-up on the broadcast itself. One wanted it to be treated a bit more like a football match, with a bit of sort of analysis and discussion before, and indeed a bit of analysis and discussion afterwards. I mean, I suppose he's got some of that on the news at 10 afterwards, but before it just felt like we were straight into it, and then we had these three sort of statements to camera, didn't we, from starting with Clegg, and it just felt like we were in a sort of three-headed party political broadcast. So it was a very sort of poor and slow start. Although the show did improve and there were some better moments, I don't think it was that decisive any which way, despite the verdicts of the papers.
The thing is that ITV never get these things quite as good as the BBC. And well, it'll be interesting to see how Sky do next week. The set was a bit Krypton factor, I thought. But yes. What did you think, Steve?
I thought it was actually rather good. I very much enjoyed Nick Clegg's performance and the fact that he actually came up with some policies. I think that his Trident moments were probably the best moments of the show. I thought that
half the audience would have known what Trident was.
I don't know. Actually, when you looked in the audience, apart from that young boy who asked the question, they weren't a very young audience, were they?
Fair enough.
I mean, the audience was the strangest thing. I think the fact that the audience weren't allowed to make any noise was very odd.
I mean,
if Dan wants, Dan wants a sort of the Andy Gray Sky Sports experience with his leaders' debates, then you certainly need a bit of clapping, cheering, laughing, booing, hissing, whatever.
I tried to watch it online. ITV.com had their worm, the sentiment tracker. And that was actually quite a good idea, except...
It was quite compelling.
It was quite compelling, except ITV.com crashed on me three times throughout, which was frustrating. Not surprising, given the weight of interest, but frustrating. That, at least, you had some sort of the Andy Gray dimension, where you just felt, I'm feeling like I'm getting some real-time analysis.
Yes, well, apart from the fact that it was very diverting for about 10 minutes, and then you start to think, what is this telling me? Yes. And it actually doesn't tell you anything at all. It's just weirdly, addictive.
Actually, worryingly enough, I'd have to admit, after about the first 10 minutes or so, one of the first things I did when it started that was a bit dull, I'll go straight to the sort of online tools and find out what the polling data is. And the worm was quite interesting. But then I got suspicious later on as I realised it was switched from Cameron to Clegg to Brown and the thing would barely move up or down. And you sort of thought, hang on a minute, we can't all be rating these people equally.
Well, they had a representative sample, didn't they, of people doing that, twiddling ITV's knobs in the back room, I think is what they were doing.
Sorry, I didn't see their worm, but I was looking at the guardian.co.uk.
Yes, we had a tracker,
The tracker, which actually did sort of seem to tell you something. And, you could see Clegg growing and growing and Cameron sort of hovering a bit lower down. Our tracker was people who were getting in touch with a Guardian voting system, presumably.
That's right. Our tracker was completely unscientific. it is no secret that halfway through the evening we did notice that there were quite a lot of votes coming from Lib Dem HQ. So we blocked them.
they were quite a small percentage, though, weren't
it was they? I think you can probably assume that each party equally is probably trying to do these things. But no, broadly, it did sort of match the polling data at the end that you got from some of those instant polls, which put Clegg first, Brown second, Cameron third. What about the presenter? Alistair Stewart, he's an ITV veteran, isn't he? He's the person they wheel out for election night. What did you think of
it? But they don't really do as much of this type of stuff as the BBC, do they? I mean, you imagine that the BBC, when they've got Dimbleby, he does these things all the time. ITV doesn't really do these sort of things very often. I thought he did all right, actually. I mean, most of the time the candidates seemed exceedingly polite and were quite happy to sort of speak for a minute and a half and hand over. And Stewart, interjected three or four times.
Mm. I was a bit less convinced. I think the 76 rules meant that there wasn't much of a role for the moderator there, and Alistair Stewart was sort of just trying to keeping order, I guess. He seemed to be reduced to shouting a bit at the various
he was a bit shouty.
candidates, and he muffed the timing of the Scottish and Welsh debates. Yeah. But anyway, never mind. A small point. I mean, it was a very strange sort of setup, and actually, the candidates sort of policed themselves. But I think all that said, despite the oddities of the format, it was clearly better viewing than I thought it was going to be. I feared, that after about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, I'd find it unendurable. Actually, it picked up.
Did you stick with it?
Yes, I'd stick with it for the whole 90. And it picked up, I would say, after the first 20, particularly as...
Well, it's interesting because the viewing figures show that as well. The viewing figures climbed through 8.45 to 9 o'clock and peaked, I think, between 9 and 9.15 and then tailed off a bit. But even the last quarter hour was still higher than the first quarter hour, which is very interesting.
Well, that's intriguing. I think Brown was at his best at about 9 when he started to challenge Cameron and seemed to loosen up after what was a very sort of poor start. And that was, I think, one of the only few moments of genuine dynamism in the debate. And I think people felt they either felt they should stick to the format very rigidly, or they felt that was the right thing to do. I think Cameron felt it was the right thing to do was to be a bit imperious, presidential, quote-unquote, and just stand off and try not to get dragged down.
And I don't think you mentioned the rules. I don't think the restrictiveness of the rules was restrictive enough to make it a television disaster, because I think that if that had happened, there would have been a big clamour to go back on the rules and start renegotiating them. And I don't get the sense today that there's any suggestion of that. What about all the... there were obviously earlier in the week the manifesto launches. I wonder how you thought they went down as a media event. Labour clearly hadn't worked out that if you put Brown in front of a big screen, there's going to be lots of, or anyone in front of a big screen, there's going to be lots of flickering. And that didn't look very good, did it?
It didn't. I don't think Brown has been that assured a performer at these sort of big set-piece events. In fact, throughout the campaign, he's looked quite nervous. He didn't look very relaxed in front of number 10 when he was calling the election. Again, I don't think he looked very relaxed at the manifesto launch. The Conservatives obviously thought a lot harder about how they're going to present things with their multiple presenters and the sort of beautiful women dotted in the audience wearing the sort of Conservative T-shirts, I felt. But look, the Conservatives are clearly slicker and better organised, and yet, despite all that, they're not quite punching through in the polls. No, they're not in that 10-point lead. And I thought Brown had the best line of the TV debate last night, where he was talking about, you know, you can airbrush your posters, but you can't airbrush your
Your
policies.
I thought that sounded a bit pre-cooked, though. Really, really
was,
sort of prepared.
You could spot the pre-prepared comments, yeah, couldn't you? You could tell when they thought, oh, now's my opportunity, yes, to use this line that I've been given before. I mean, I think what Dan says about Brown is true, but I think it's always been true. He's not that natural a performer, and I think that, you know, one of the things that worries me about the Prime Minister debate is the idea that, you know, that we're turning it into some sort of American presidential thing, mm, and they actually, but who is the Prime Minister is everything. And actually, yeah,
I mean,
you
Nick
know,
Clegg
what you
was
get,
quite, Nick Clegg was good, but he's no Barack Obama, is he? You know, yeah.
No, but, you know, but actually, you know, to go back to my previous point, I think where Clegg actually did well in the debate was, you know, apart from the moment when he said, you know, you listen to these two arguing and, you know, and they just sound the same, mm, was the fact that he actually said a couple of policies. You know, they've had a manifesto launch. He actually said some things that were in it that were new and interesting to people.
I think we'll leave the policies to Politics Weekly, shall we? Let's leave that there. It's Sky next week, of course, so we'll see how they do. The viewing figures won't be nearly as big because it's on Sky. But never mind Nick Robinson and Adam Bolton. You can keep up to date throughout the campaign with our very own Michael White and his daily election podcast, which is at guardian.co.uk/audio. And there's much more on Brown, Cameron, Clegg and the rest of them at your one-stop shop for all things political, guardian.co.uk/election2010. I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk. We'll be coming on to an exciting week at Radio 4 shortly. First, though, let's take a look at the other media news in brief. Dan, let's start with you. Paywalls, I thought I wanted to bring you in on.
And oh, yeah.
I thought you might have a view or two on those.
Okay.
Gordon Brown, no less, has said that people who are used to free content shouldn't have to pay for news. Are you where do you stand now that you're unencumbered by your News International past?
I think I've got two views on paywalls, which are nicely contradictory.
Excellent.
It makes decent commercial sense for the Times and I, and I think commercially they could probably do quite well out of it. Actually, I think
they're actually pitching them quite well. When you see how they're being advertised, it does make you look as if they're thinking about what extra things to offer behind the paywall.
Yeah, I think the number of subscribers you need to declare victory, even at the sort of bargain basement £2 a week price they've talked about, is relatively modest. I think it's 200,000 sort of incremental new subscribers. And you should think of this, by the way, as a rather cute price cut, because effectively it's a play to try and get your 2 million Sunday Times readers to come in to buy the Times during the week for the same price as Sunday Times, and thereby undercutting the Telegraph. All this high-minded talk of it being we've got to pay for quality journalism is a very nice disguise for what is a serious price cut. Look similarly at how Rupert sells the Journal online, WSJ.com. Again, it's sold for a bargain basement price, you know, significantly undercutting FT.com. And that's absolutely
classic.
He's
bringing his old price wars to the internet.
Yes, it just doesn't look like a price war because people are not being concentrated. It's emphatically a move because the fundamental problem when you've got the Times and Sunday Times sitting there is why on earth does the Times sell, you know, less than half the Sunday Times? How can I just get my Sunday Times audience to buy my daily product? And if I can do that, wow, I could declare victory. So I think commercially it could do quite well, and it, you know, and Sky does quite well, the obvious analog. But in audience terms, I think that's where the real challenge is. You know, privately, they're talking about losing, 90% plus of the audience. I mean, I think that's pretty realistic.
That's the received wisdom.
Yeah. I think clearly you are going to lose that many. There just aren't going to be that many subscribers, any which way you count it. It becomes probably more important to put out real-time news for this small band of subscribers because these are paying customers after all, and yet you'll have a relatively modest audience. So when I was there, a moderately well sort of hit story will get in the sort of tens of thousands of views. I mean, these figures are going to drop to terribly low numbers, and I think the loss of reach I think will be a bit of a shock to the system.
It'll be really interesting, Steve, to see how the rest of the media world picks up on stories that the Times breaks. Because at the moment, the Times, like, you know, at least once this week, the Times broke a significant story online during the day, which we all followed up. It was the they got hold of the letter that the 77 economists supporting Gordon Brown, and they put it up online. So we followed it up and linked to it. But we wouldn't have even known it was there, really, if it was behind the paywall. It'll be interesting to see whether their influence amongst their peers drops.
Well, I don't think that's true, actually. I mean, I think what will happen is that every other newsroom will have a subscription to the Times. We'll all be watching what they're putting on it. Then we'll write the story and we'll try to link to it. And we'll say, you can follow this link if you want, but you're not actually going to be able to do it unless you're prepared to pay. Hmm. I mean, to go back to Dan's point, I think this is very much a newspaper strategy put onto the web, and I think the way that Rupert thinks is that, you know, if the money's coming in, I don't really care how many people read us, as long as we're making the dough, and if they only get 1% of their readership that they're paying, in his head, that I think that's better, and arguably it is.
Well, obviously, while all the debate online is about paying, all the debate offline is about going free. And the latest title to go free is an unusual one. Trinity Mirror is launching the Birmingham Post Lite. What do we make of that? It's sort of, they've done everything with the Birmingham Post, haven't they? They've relaunched it, they've redesigned it, and Trinity Mirror, are really struggling in that area. No views on the Birmingham Post. All right.
Well, fine. No. I was going to make the point that you made. Really, Birmingham has been a basket case for Trinity Mirror for a long time. It seems to be a very difficult market to get a regional title going. I suspect, dare I say, it's probably been underinvested in. Mm. But the reality is, sort of, the big city regionals have found it very tough, and Birmingham is maybe just about close enough to London to not quite have enough of an identity. I don't know.
Oh, you can't say that, Dan. Well, you really can't claim that Birmingham hasn't got an identity. You really can't.
What is it about Birmingham that's a bit different to Liverpool and Manchester, where regional titles at Newcastle are faring a bit better? I take the point that I'm probably wrong. But
they talk like that's right? For start.
No. Okay, but there must be something a bit different about
it. It's interesting why I went to university in Birmingham. I don't, and I never quite understood why the regional media didn't work as strongly and wasn't as strongly identified with the city as say the Liverpool Post is. The Liverpool Echo is with Liverpool, and the MEN was with Manchester.
Well, the Birmingham conurbation is quite large for stuff. So there's different papers, isn't there? Because there's the Express and Star, which takes it Wolverhampton, which is when you compare it to London, it would be like there being about five different newspapers circulating in London comparatively to Birmingham. I think there's also been quite a history of, quite a lot of free sheets launching in Birmingham over the years. And I think, there's sort of a strange culture of those local free newspapers that have been given away. And I think it's probably just too late for the Birmingham Post, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like yet another last roll of the dice. There probably are
probably a few more left.
There'll probably still be a few more despite that. But
anyway. All right, well, more into more successful news. Well, interestingly, the iPad has been delayed for a month, the launch of the iPad. Do you think that makes it more desirable, or does it indicate that they've got problems?
Well, they're claiming that it's because they've sold so damn many that they just can't get them out fast enough. And, there's clearly a sort of, an I want one culture going on. But I think most people are probably going to wait till the second or third generation when the price has dropped a bit and they've, added some of the features that they haven't got. They've added a clock so that you can tell the time while you're doing it. And got better, because Wi-Fi is one of the problems with it at the moment, isn't it? They need to redesign the antenna, apparently.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I've we've had one in the building which people have been playing with, which I still don't really see it. I don't get it. It's heavy. It gets hot, and it's you put it on the table in front of you, and you start thinking, oh, I need to prop it up, or I need to use it like a computer. It's just, I don't know.
Well, maybe they'll add a little thing to prop it up with.
Yeah, I think you can do the stand.
There'll be some company will sell the stands at $29.99.
Yes, a bit of plastic. Exactly, yeah. Absolutely.
Have you seen the Daily Express demo? It's on YouTube, actually, and it just gives you a sort of an idea of what you could do with an iPad at a fairly basic level from a newspaper point of view. Worth a look.
Okay. The Daily Express on the iPad?
Yes.
Good Lord.
I know, it's worth looking for that alone. Yeah. I mean, it's not... don't get me wrong, it's a pretty basic demo. It's not as sophisticated as some of the things you've seen with Sports Illustrated, but it's worth a quick look, actually, and they seem to be slightly ahead of the game or slightly ahead of everyone else.
Good tip. Twitter had a big announcement this week. They plan to make money, Dan, don't they, which is very interesting, which seems to be the first time that we've heard about a strategy to make money.
Isn't that the joke, isn't it? You know, what does the biz in Biz Stone stand for? It can't be business model.
It's quite a good joke.
Twitter,
I
certainly,
can't believe
it,
I've heard it before.
It's not mine. It's certainly not mine. I can't. Anyway, Twitter's clearly got something going because, I mean, wow, we all love it. We use it in such a powerful way, and all sorts of people are trying to build predictive models on the back of it, like the Tweetminster guys trying to predict the result of the election and so forth. So there's got to be a way of making money. Mm. I think for me, it's got to be around kind of market research and analysis and so forth. I mean, they'll get there. I'm not entirely sure that they'll get there in the first go, but they'll get there. It's too popular to fail.
Yeah, I mean, because it's going to be promoted to tweets, isn't it?
That's so,
you know, so if you're looking up Justin Bieber, which, you know, which most of the world seems to do, presumably there's going to be a little link that's, you know, a little tweet that comes at the top of the bar that says, you know, buy Justin Bieber's record here or whatever. Mm. If they manage to keep it like the Google search where, you know, where you look for something, you get, you know, several thousand offers of what you might want, and at the top is one that's been paid for, and you can clearly see that it's one that that's been paid for, and it's clearly relevant. Then, you know, then that might just about be all right. If you end up getting a whole load of promoted tweets coming in amongst you, the rest of stuff that
that's going to be really annoying.
That
yes.
might be quite annoying. Yeah.
Okay, listen, let's wrap up the section with just a quick one on poor old Adrian Childs. First, he was told to get rid of his beard for looking too scruffy, and now he's been dumped from the Friday edition of The One Show in favour of Chris Evans.
I thought he got rid of his beard for charity.
Was it? Oh, well, maybe I misread the tabloids.
I've heard that beards are in. I mean, this is a classic Chris Evans thing, isn't it? Because, you know, because he had all those years when he was on the breakfast in the mornings, and then he was doing TFI Friday on a Friday night, and eventually his head exploded because he was doing too much, and, you know, and he was working probably like 4 a.m. on Monday morning until 9 o'clock on Friday night. So I think there's a danger for the BBC that if they try and get that. I'm not sure if Adrian Childs has actually signed his new contract yet either. Isn't there? There's a sort of a, well, you know, why am I doing this show all week and then you're giving the big night of the week to Chris Evans? But there's an idea that, you know, they've got to try and make Friday nights a bit different. Plus, of course, Adrian Childs has got his Sunday night gig, hasn't he?
So, well, that's true, yes. Are you a fan of Adrian Childs? Are you a fan of Chris Evans?
I'm a fan of Adrian Childs, and of Chris Evans is fine. Mm. I do think this is a rather ill judge move by Chris. I think you know, the Radio 2 gig is a
he needs to stick to that and get that right.
When I last looked, that was the best gig in the whole of radio.
And he's, do the One Show on Fridays,
and now he wants to sort of stretch himself. And I'm very surprised that Tim Davey is tolerant of that. I think that's high risk. I mean, clearly they feel they can't say no to Chris, which is again another worrying sign. Yes. The BBC feels they can't say no.
Well,
this is
where it all went wrong before. Wasn't it?
Yeah, I do think the sort of the London media bubble does sort of not really think about the One Show very much. It's not, you know, not a program that enters.
But actually, it's massive.
It's watched by a lot of people. I mean, you know, I love that scene in the was it the Royal Family Christmas special?
I was just thinking about the same thing where they all sing the theme tune to the One Show. Yeah, I know. We're not going to do it here. All right, that's it. We can read more on most of these stories. Probably at beehivecity.com and definitely all of them on mediaguardian.co.uk.
We don't take it quite so seriously, so we'll be there.
Yeah, we'll be there. Excellent. We don't take it seriously here either.
I mean, I can see that.
Yeah. And I listened two-thirds into the show and not a single gag about volcanic ash from Iceland. We'll finish this week with the big news from Broadcasting House, which is that Radio 4 controller Mark Damoser has announced that he's leaving the BBC to become the head of St Peter's College at Oxford University. It means one of the most coveted jobs in UK radio is now up for grabs. We'll come on to some of his potential successes in a moment. Let's first, though, just reflect on Damoser's 6 years at Radio 4. How do we think the man with the famously bulging brain has done? It's been, I mean, the reaction has been, you know, he's, the write-ups of him have been mostly positive, Steve, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was probably, he was the right sort of person to do that job. I mean, when he first got that job, I think it was a sideways move for him, you know, because he'd been slightly in the firing line over Hutton and his argument that it was because he'd helped Dyke write the original report and said, you know, it was all about semantics, which wasn't enough of a defence, really, and he got into a bit of a bother about that. But, you know, but they clearly still rated him, and Radio 4 is a really big job, and I think most people think that he has done fine, but, you know, probably because he hasn't rocked the boat too much. I mean, the worst thing that you can do at Radio 4 is say, do you know what, I'm going to move the Archers to a completely different time of day, or, you know, I'm going to move the Archers by 10 minutes is enough to upset an awful lot of people who listen to that. I mean, he's got rid of the Friday play, which I think has upset some people, but, you know, but he claims that there's still going to be plenty of investment in drama. He introduced the new presenter to Desert Island Discs,
Kirsty Young,
which
has worked well. But he ditched the UK theme, which went down badly.
But the UK theme, I mean, it's this tiny bit of music at this very early in the morning. God knows how many people listen to it. Not very many.
Yeah, but he did bring in, of course, Fee Glover, Martha Carney, and Jane Garvey, and promoted all those people, Evan Davis on Today. Although he never got to grips with this issue, which is still bubbling on, which is the issue of white male presenters on the Today programme.
I think Mark's tenure was a pretty sad one. I mean, Radio 4 is such a well-oiled machine that all you've really got to do is keep stroking the talent and introduce sort of new talent progressively. I think you're right about the demographics of Radio 4. It could do with some younger voices and some blacker voices, and it does feel wonderful, though it is to listen to. Not, by the way, as good as this show, or indeed anything the Garden puts out. Wonderful it is to listen to. It does. You do feel that you have to grow into Radio 4, and you're sort of entering into kind of sort of middle class Britain, circa 1963.
Maybe that's your problem, Dan.
Well, I think I think he's brought it forward to a bit 1969. Maybe. I think
but there's still
his achievement.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it is. That said, it is the only radio station that you could sort of listen to from sort of 9 in the morning till 7 at night and not be bored and not feel you've listened to the same song, or say, 104 times. wonderful diversity.
Mentioning no radio stations in particular. Yes. What about successors, Steve? Have we done the Media Garden compulsory runners and riders yet?
We have done a runners and riders. Although I think it's quite open.
Was it well informed, or were they just the usual guesses?
Obviously it was well informed. We went and spoke to some very key people.
You didn't have Rowley Keating on your list, and I would certainly have a £5 on Rowley.
That's not a bad call. Yeah. That isn't a bad call.
Who else was up there?
Graham Ellis, George Entwistle, Tim Souter, Richard Klein, Peter Barron, possibly as an outsider. Having sort of left the BBC, I think he'd come back for that job. Whether he'd get it or not is another question. And the sort of the best inside Radio 4 tip is a gent called Moet Bakaya, who's the Commissioner of Specialist Factual Programmes. Probably not him, I'm suspecting, though, because it's a fairly political appointment. When Damsa got it, he hadn't come from inside Radio 4. And it's a big call for Tim Davey,
first big appointment, isn't it, really? Well, as the first casualty put it on the blog, how about someone who isn't male and white and or Oxbridge? But there's not a big field to choose from. All those runners and riders you've pointed out are pretty much all male. I don't think you mentioned I don't think there was not a single woman there.
Jenny Russell,
there we are, there's one. In other radio news, Tim Davey says Six Music will not become Radio 2 Extra, so that's one for the fans of Six Music to digest. And Ofcom has said that it's going to deregulate local radio. I don't think that's very exciting either, so I don't think we'll spend any more time with that.
I think they've sort of slipped it through. I think it's a little bit like, I mean, you know, it's been made possible because of the wash-up digital economy bill that went through last week. And, you know, and they're going to allow an awful lot more cooperation between commercial rivals in different areas. And I think it might, you know, reduce choice. It might give commercial radio the bit of a fillip, which, you know, at the moment it's in big financial problems. Mm.
Okay, thank you very much to both of you. Before we go, Dan and Steve, this is the point of the podcast where you tell us something that you've learned in the week in your travels, in your lunching, and the contacts building that you're doing. And I'm sure, you know, Dan, that this is an extensive piece of work that you do these days. What can you download from us from your incredibly big brain?
I don't know where the brain is. I think the thing I'm very interested in is what's going to happen to the Crown Jewel sporting event. think what happens when the Tory, what happens when, if the Conservatives win the next election, I think there's a little, there's a rather interesting remarks made by a chap called Hugh Robertson, who's a Conservative shadow sports minister, saying it's going to be all up for grabs again. The Crown Jewel, you'll recall here that the Ben Bradshaw bring back the ashes to the BBC plan got washed out in the wash-up, so we have to do it all over again if we're going to do it at all. And if you're looking for a place where Sky might get what it wants, might get a bit more deregulation from the Conservatives.
Mm. Oh, I'm fairly certain.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think that's the thing. That's the thing I'm interested in.
That's the thing to watch out for.
Yeah, this week.
Steve?
Having listened to Whitney Houston sing, I'd say that that my Elvis Presley impersonations are better than her Whitney Houston.
I think that's right, actually. Well, the listeners get that.
Can I tell you one fascinating fact that I learned this week, which is that we count among our many band of happy listeners, one Diane Abbott MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington, who I met this week, and the first thing she said was, "You're Matt Wells. I listen to Media Talk." Isn't that interesting? Of all the people that you would have thought, I mean, lots of people that you would have thought might listen to the programme. I don't think Diane Abbott would be.
Well, she's a media star these days.
She is, absolutely.
On that very, very small sofa.
Yes, it is a very small sofa.
So hello to
Diane Abbott. Although I suppose in the interests of balance, we should also say an equally big hello to the other candidates in Hackney North and Stoke Newington, Darren Kaplan, Keith Angus, Matt Selwood and Suzanne Moore from the Mail on Sunday, who's standing as an independent.
And also to Michael Portillo, so he doesn't feel left out.
We don't need to do him. On that diplomatic note, we say thank you very much to Steve Busfield from Media Guardian and Dan Sabba from Beehive City. Emily Bell is back in the pod next week, but for now, post all your comments and feedback on our blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, or find us over on Twitter and Facebook in the usual places. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. See you next time.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.